Thank you all for joining us. And when are we going to hear him?
Later on, probably Friday.
By way of announcements, I've retrieved HB 2733 and HB 2953 from the subs. We'll hear them in full committee or act on them. Consider them in full committee Friday of this week.
Sorry, once again, the bill number, sir?
2733 and 2953. What's the tagline on those, Sandy? What's the word on those?
2733 requires covered entities to report annually on system safeguards for protecting confidentiality of individually identifiable health information. And 2953 requires health benefit plans to cover bone mass measurements.
Yeah, we've heard both of those. Okay.
This is what was on my... I don't know.
Do we have amendments on 2953?
Well, we had them in sub, and Debbie is here to speak to the amendments. And yes, we do have the bench.
We are going to put 3501 on. Yeah, I do. Do I have to open a work session to do that? I'll open a work session on HB 3501. The parties are working on this. I hear it from both the parties and from semi-neutral sources. So I'm going to carry over HB 3501 until Friday.
Okay.
And I hope we will have an agreement. We have an agreement and we want it in statute. Please get me the amendments, or if we don't need that amendments, then we'll just assume you're working it on your own, and that will be fine.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, ma'am.
May I just comment on that? Thank you.
Please.
For keeping that alive. That is a bill that I put in the Legislative Council, and there is a one-word tweak we need to do on that, but I'm hoping the parties will come back together. If not, I'd like to move it with an amended version because I think it's important.
You want to move it now?
You
say with the amended, or we can
No, Friday's fine. I just want to make sure that...
That's the greater lesser question.
Yes, you've got it. Thank you.
Okay. Or equal to. We have all sorts of options. I'll close the work session on 3501. Let's see. We can handle 3486 rather quickly, I think. Is that right? Let's open a work session on HB 3486. It comes to us from the Policy Committee. And Representative Bruin, I think you're carrying it to us.
I am carrying it to you. And I assume, Sandy, that we've adopted the one. We don't have to adopt the ones here, do we? Okay. Mr. Chair, I bring House Bill 3486, which passed unanimously out of the Health Care Policy Subcommittee. It, in its original form, it asked the Department of Human Services to establish a plan, a comprehensive plan with some teeth in it to slow the rate of diabetes. When it was first reported to us, the early analysis was that that's fine, very expensive to do that in sort of the time frame that we had allotted. After a little bit of work with some amendments, we got the first amendment, the -1 amendment back, which, according to the department, lets them do what we wanted them to do, the sponsors of the bill wanted them to do, but not have the blow it out of the water price tag. It establishes to work with some already some good work that's already been done by the department, by others, namely the Oregon Diabetes Coalition, working with the American Diabetes Association, with the full intent of getting our arms around and slowing the rate and, importantly, the cost of diabetes going forward. And I think it's important to note here, Mr. Chair, that the primary reason for doing this bill is a recognition that diabetes has, if it hasn't always been, it's at least now recognized to be the most expensive chronic care component within our public health system and the public health dollars we spend. So if we're serious about both effective and improving the human condition as well as doing our fiduciary responsibility as legislators to get our arms around the costs, diabetes, especially type 2 diabetes, is where we need to spend a lot of our focus, time and focus.
And Administrator, does this have a subsequent?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it does not.
They have a fiscal statement.
At this point, it does not. I did call this morning to see where we were at in the process. As you all may know, they are extremely overwhelmed. He was not able to get back to me. And we just put in a couple of key questions to the agency to verify, in fact, that the amendment does minimize the fiscal so that the statement is forthcoming, but is not here for our evaluation.
Can we send this to the floor as it is?
Mr. Chair, if you send it, it does not have a prior reference, so there would be no need for permission. The only change would be that if we had a fiscal impact, then the committee would need to take up some consideration of that, either back here in the committee or on the floor.
Or, Mr. Chair, as did occur today, a bill was referred, pulled from the floor and referred back to committee due to the fiscal impact.
Right.
Mr. Chair. It's good to be back. If it happened, as it did today, that it got pulled from committee and sent back to the committee, what impact does
it... Sorry, if it got...
So say we passed the bill out of committee today and it ended up with a fiscal impact statement. It got to the floor and then we needed to send it back to the committee. What's the timeline on that? Oh, it would go directly to Ways and Means, so we wouldn't run into it. I just want to make sure that we don't die.
It wouldn't come back here.
April 30th.
If it turns out that it has a significant fiscal, and I think DHS wants it not to have a significant fiscal. They've been working hard with us, and we've been making the language such that it should make it easier on them. Is there anybody from DHS want to talk about this?
No? Holland is here, but...
Would you like to give us a clue as to where we are here? Do you have a sense?
Chair Green, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Dr. Mel Cohn, state epidemiologist at the Public Health Division of the Department of Human Services. We do not anticipate that there would be a fiscal impact with this bill. We've worked with Representative Bruin and with Ledge Council to craft language that would get us there.
That'd be great. A memo from you to that effect. Representative Bruin could read on the floor would probably be very nice. All right. It sounds like we're ready for a motion.
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill, I'm sure I got the right one in my hand, House Bill 3486 to the floor with a due pass recommendation, as amended to the floor.
As amended with a dash form.
Right.
Is there any discussion on that? Dr. Cohn, thank you very much for that. Aaron, would you please see the roll?
Aye.
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 Aye. You need a carrier. Are there any volunteers?
I'd be delighted, Mr. Chair.
Great. Thank you very much. And we'll try and have that note from VHS on the way. I'd like to open up a work session on 3094. Not only I'd like to, I will. I'll open up a work session on 3094. Mr. Davis here today? Representative of the dentures? My amendment to the bill?
You had asked.
Right. Yeah, actually, we do have an amendment. Let's work that amendment right now. But where I'm going is, before we add this, which at least some of the folks from the insurance side say is completely unnecessary, if there are any problems, they can be worked out. I'd like to give the parties a chance to actually try and work those out between now and Friday. So what I would like to do, we have a dash one amendment that simply cleans up the language. Language is a little slot. Oh, there's Mr. Davis. Mr. Davis, can I have you and Mr. Dewey up here for a moment?
Good to see you.
We have opened a work session on 3094. We're going to put an amendment on in a minute, and then postpone until Friday. Friday should be a busy day.
Oh, yeah.
I'd like you two to sit down and see if you can work out something that works for you. I mean, I think it is, as Mr. Dewey says, proper and important that the denturists get paid on time. He argues that we can try to find a way to make sure that that happens on a regular basis. And so I'd rather do that than pass a statute about it. So if you could get your parties together over the next few days and maybe let us know by Friday if you still think the bill is going to be necessary. If the bill is necessary, we'll pass the bill or some amended form of it, but it would be, my preference would be not to have to do that.
Mr. Chair, if I may, for the record, Mike Huey representing the ODS companies. So the context is in perspective. ODS processes about 65% of the dental claims. And when those claims come in, they're blind. It's be a denturist, a dentist, whatever the case may be, whether to be sure it's covered. What I would suggest, Mr. Chair, if Mr. Davis and his client could come forth with some information as to what they think is happening out there in their real world, I guess compared to ours, that would be useful. So we could get a sense if there's a glitch somewhere in what is a clean claim, because it has to be clean, obviously, before you're going to pay it. So like the physicians did when we first developed the statute and the rule, they made a case, came to the insurance company, and we would be happy, I think, to sit down and have the, if you will, the claims folks sit down with his folks to see if there are, in fact, some internal issues that we're not aware of, because we just don't see the issue. But he's talking from his client's point of view, and they do. So we'd be happy to have that conversation.
I frankly don't think adding dental to medical turns it into a big hardship for you all, but and I'd be willing to do that, but I'd much rather it be solved outside. Mr. Davis?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for giving us the opportunity to share with you today. As you can see from the response you've just heard, there's probably little likelihood that we will reach compromise within the next few days. Really, all we're trying to do is add a few words to this part of the statute, and we're a little mystified as to why ODS would be opposed to adding dental into prompt pay. He talks about having 65% of the market that they're dealing with. What about the other 35%? Shouldn't they be held to certain standards? And I guess the question that we're asking is that if they do pay promptly, as he indicated in his previous testimony, then why are they in disagreement with having that language put into statute? I mean, if they're doing it already, all this is doing is just allowing for that to be in the statute and making it clear that in the dental community, they deserve prompt payment just like anyone else. And so we're a little mystified. And so, yes, I'll sit down with him and we'll talk. And but we have yet to understand why there's such opposition. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I share that sense of mystery and mystification. To me, if I look at the statute as it currently exists, the absence of oral health care providers is glaringly absent from that list of providers that should be paid promptly. And if the disagreement is about whether or not oral health care providers are reimbursed in a timely way and appropriately, and the disagreement is either they are or they aren't, if the argument of the insurance industry is that they already are, it doesn't seem like passage of the bill would be a significant burden. And it seems fair for healthcare providers to expect prompt payment for their for their services. So I don't have a problem with this bill. I personally wouldn't have a problem with moving it today if that was your pleasure. And I don't see the harm, but I do see a benefit in moving forward.
Okay. Representative Kotek?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just ditto what Representative Gelser said. I don't understand what the issue is.
Well, if it's a pleasure of the committee, we can move this out today and say...
Mr. Chair.
I'll feel you.
Thank you. I appreciate your recommendation that perhaps the parties sit down and try to resolve whatever might be the issues between them. And I know sometimes we have a tendency to want to put the heavy hand of government behind things, but if it's not necessary, then why go there?
I think when I do it, it's a light touch of government.
I made a note one time when you said heavy hand of legislation. I wrote it down.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My only, I would ditto what Representatives Gelser and Kotek said and only add that the risk I see in, or not the risk, but I would expect that if we sent the two off, we wouldn't get a complete solution, if only because Mr. Dewey represents, as he admits, only 65% of the market here. So we'd still be, I mean, we're not having a work group that brings everyone to the table. So there's a certain part of me that says, if that's the case, let's just go ahead and do what seems right for 100% of the market.
Yes, Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Representative.
Anybody else down there?
I think the one thing that I would add, I agree with Representative Flores that when we don't need legislation, we shouldn't have it. And I think I would feel differently about this bill if the statutory language wasn't already there covering providers, and all this does is includes a third kind of provider. So if it was a completely new statute that was adding everyone in and talking about this issue in a new way, I would definitely agree that we could come up with a mutually agreeable solution that might be better. But given the presentations that were here, it leaves me, and I'm an optimist, not overly optimistic that there will be a consensus product that comes back on Friday. And when I first saw the bill, just looking through and seeing that dental, or here it's listed as oral health, wasn't included in that list of providers was just puzzling to me. As a covered service, it seems like the providers of that covered service should expect the same treatment from the insurance carriers as other providers of covered services.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I'm sorry, Representative Richardson.
Representative Richardson?
I'm still trying to figure out what is the wrong that we're trying to fix. When we had our hearings, there was no evidence brought forward other than a couple of anecdotal issues or statements that I've been told that sometimes they don't pay. I mean, I don't remember any evidence brought forward. And then the dentists have now come forward and saying, we have no problem with what's going on. So there's a letter.
I could respond to that.
Pull that letter. There's a letter that from the dentist saying that they don't see any problem.
I didn't see a letter from the dentist. I don't remember a letter from the dentist.
This is the only dental bill, right, that we're dealing with today?
This is the only dental bill today.
Mr. Chair, if I may, just to add a commentary, and it's up to you as whether or not I speak, so I'll see.
Please go ahead, and then Jim also.
Yeah, just
jumping up and down.
Yeah, just to be sure here, it is somewhat interesting that the Oregon Dental Association has not spoke on this bill, and that's where the vast
majority.
One way or the other, but that, at least in my mind, tells me something. If there were an issue here, they would be here today. With regard to the bill itself, it deals with, if you will, medical services. That was initial, so we're not talking about a vast array of providers that somehow the dental community was not included. It's a very narrow statute to begin with, and it was a narrow statute because there was an issue that the physicians brought forward, and they were able to demonstrate that there was some issues on clean claims and the like. Is it the biggest issue in the world? No. For you that have heard from the insurance companies, we're not really excited about more laws, notwithstanding the fact that this isn't going to be the biggest expense in the world because we're doing it. It isn't a way, in my mind, to reward companies that are doing the right thing. And we do have reports under the statute that are required. So these will be initial reports. I'm not going to say that that's going to cost us $1 million by any means, but that is the fact. We have reports that we're going to have to provide.
You know that no good deed goes unpunished.
I understand that.
Mr. Davis.
It's the Oregon legislature.
The world.
Well, you know,
Mr.
Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jim Davis, United Seniors of Oregon, Oregon State Council for Retired Citizens, and the Oregon State Denturist Association. I guess my first response is, if they're doing it, then what's the problem? And if they're doing it, then why would it cost any more? Because they're already doing it. And so what we're doing is just clarifying the law a little bit. And yes, there are problems on the medical side with clean claims. There are problems on the dental side as well. And to respond to Representative Richardson, we don't have the money to hire researchers to go through and to actually research out exactly the percentages. But we hear so much anecdotal, information that's coming in from denturists. There's only 110 denturists out in the state anyway, so it's not hard to hear from them. But we do hear a lot of stuff that denturists just aren't respected. I mean, that's really the bottom line, is that these companies don't respect denturists. And so we thought we would put something in that would enable denturists to get paid quicker, but would also help all dentists and everybody, everybody in the dental field. So it seems like a good thing. One more comment about the lack of involvement from the Oregon Dental Association. Anybody that's familiar with our relationships with the senior community as well as the denturist community with the Oregon Dental Association over the last 20 years would know that normally every session they oppose almost anything that we do dealing with denturists. We considered the fact that they didn't, we've talked to their lobbyists. There's been no problems that they've raised with it. We're not going to tend to link arms with the Dental Association, but I think this is a clear indication that they have no problems with it because, of course, their people will benefit from it. So I don't think that's necessarily an indicator at all. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Representative Flores?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I was just going to reflect similarly as Representative Richardson. Apparently this came from the Access Committee. Did this come from the subcommittee? All I have then is a couple of documents. It wasn't?
It wasn't voted on.
It came...
brought it up from?
It came without recommendation.
Okay. I don't have anything from the United States Council for Retired Citizens and the United Seniors of Oregon. I guess that's your group.
Oh, we did. We handed in.
There is in my file.
There are letters.
That tracks a verifiable problem, and anecdotes are fine, and I respect those in the context of certain contemplations, but when we're talking about public policy, I'd like to be able to verify it on something other than some reports that don't have some tracking measurement to them. So that's my only concern, Mr. Chair, about voting on this particular bill today.
Okay. Representative Mark.
Well, I'm going to maybe bring a little different perspective here. I look at the language as it exists and wonder why dental wasn't included in the first place when the original language was passed. And so that tells me that there was a reason that dental wasn't included. And historically, the dental community has kept the distance from the medical community for a number of reasons. And a lot of it is regulatory and how dentists are regulated a lot differently than the medical community is regulated from the state and a number of compliance issues. But today, and I know that in the past there were issues with claims because there's been a long history of that payment issue, but today when we submit a clean claim, that our turnaround payment is is surprisingly quick, and how that has changed is quite remarkable. But on the other hand, if you don't submit a clean claim, it's very difficult, or it's not difficult, it's just very laborious to get that corrected. And that a lot of it is really the fault of the provider. It's not, sometimes it's the fault of the insurance company. It's not always, but it's, I'll say, half and half. But the issue is that if you, if they tell you what is clean and what isn't clean. I mean, this isn't rocket science as far as determining what's a clean claim and what isn't. And so, I can probably go back in a week and tell you what our percentage of clean claim submissions are and find that to be a relatively easy statistic or value to come up with. And so I'm just uncomfortable, without knowing this history, this legislative history, why it is as it is, and going forward, because I just would like to see some information, some more information beyond just the anecdote, and describe to the committee what a clean claim is and what it isn't, because it's not always apparent what is and what isn't. Even I don't always understand what is and what isn't a clean claim. But anyway, so we can move it today, but I'm not in support of the concept.
I'm not planning on moving it today. What I would like to move today is the -1 amendments, which simply meets my need for editing.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I'd like to move the -1 amendments to House Bill 3094 so we can clean it up for you.
Thank you. It just made my teeth hurt looking at the way it was. is there any discussion on that? What the -1 amendment does is it simply adds dental after medical on line 35, so it makes it medical, dental, or mental health services. And it takes all the other, it puts the italics back and takes out the bold and simply does what I think was intended with one word rather than with all that other going around. So if we add that, and then I will close the work session after that. And unless we hear that there's agreement by next Friday, we'll debate it on Friday. Hold on, I know. Is there any objection to the motion for simple language amendment? All right, -1 is added, and the work session on HB 3094 is closed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's a pleasure to be here.
You come back and tell us it's all settled and make it easier. If not, we'll debate it on Friday, along with a few other things. Do we have all the above stuff, though? No. We have HB 2952. So, kind of work session on HB 2952. We have some amendments on that. Is that right?
That is right, Mr. Chair.
We have Representative Tomei, or Representative Tomei's. Is Debbie here?
Yes.
There she is. Debbie, come and talk to us, please.
And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this also moved out of the Access Subcommittee without recommendation to get it to the full committee. So some of the bullets that you see on the SMS were just from the public hearing, but this will be the first time that the committee will hear about the amendments.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Debbie Runciman, and I'm Representative Tomei's legislative assistant. Representative Tomei is sorry she can't be here today herself. She's in another committee. We had a public hearing on this bill maybe last week before, and it's been moved now from the subcommittee without recommendation to the full. The bill basically stemmed from an article in the Oregon Health Forum that was talking about health insurers' administrative costs and the payments that they made to their CEOs. And it turns out that commercial insurers have to report CEO salaries, but the contractors for the Oregon Health Plan didn't have to report the same sorts of administrative expenses. The commercial insurers report to DCBS, the OHP contractors report to DMAP, and their forms are a little different, and one of the items that they did not have to report was the actual CEO salary. So the original bill said, let's make sure that we watch those administrative expenses and see what the CEO salaries are. In the time since that bill was drafted, we've been talking more with DMAP and looking at the other kinds of administrative expenses that they would like to see. And so that's what the amendments do. They spell out that these managed care providers need to report certain administrative expenses, and they're all listed here for you. And then in the second piece of paper I gave you, it was a report that DMAP has provided for us, and there's a little chart on it that shows what currently the form looks like. And the current reporting form has three lines dealing with administrative expenses, and it talks about compensation, marketing, and education materials, and then other administrative expenses, and they're all lumped together. So our bill then would require that the health plan contractors would spell out more of these administrative expenses, and that way we can be a little careful with our taxpayer dollars and make sure that those administrative expenses are in line.
So this document we have?
Yes, this document came from Sandy Woods at DMAP, Oregon Department of Medical Assistance Program.
And it's suggesting that in addition to what data is currently provided, this other data will be provided as well. Will this produce a fiscal on this?
Mr. Chair, I don't think so, because I think that the data would be collected and provided by the providers, the contractors. And DMAP currently does collect information, so it would just be, you know, modifying their form.
And basically what you did is take their proposed data and add it in this amendment.
Exactly.
The things that they think would be useful to have. Is there somebody from DMAP here to talk to us? And Ms. Phillips, you're jumping up and down. You want to come and talk to us? Come on. Is there somebody from DMAP?
I don't see anybody here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Paul Phillips. I represent COHO, which are the managed care organizations that will be affected by this bill. I am going to speak directly to the amendments today. Whenever I look at legislation, I say, what's the goal? What are you trying to fix? Are you looking for more information, better information, actionable information? What is the policy that best benefits the state to do this? COHO members already each quarter provide this information. Interesting question you asked, Mr. Chair. If there's no fiscal, then is there not going to be any evaluation of the information that's put forth? Kind of an interesting clue, but it's important to look through these amendments one by one. If you look through the proposed amendments, executive salaries, executive management salaries, and they're already included in administration. If you look at excess revenue in administration, the reports that we file,
not specifically
broken out, and I'll address that in a minute. But really, I think it's important for everybody to understand what's there. Claims processing is already reported. Data processing is already reported. Customer service is already reported. The general information administrative overhead is already included. Marketing and education are specifically outlined in the report formed on line 23. Provider contracting, that's an interesting issue. Provider taxes, line 28, we already report that. Investments, it's under assets. Utilization review, case management, Those are interesting, and I'll touch on those. And then providing income taxes. They're already on line 29. So the question becomes, what do you, if you're already providing C, D, E, and F on data, what else are you getting? Might I suggest, as the presenter mentioned, this was presented actually by DHS, not DCBS. Big difference, because we've got small managed care organizations that oftentimes each one of these services are done by one person. We're not talking about multinational, large insurance carriers that have multiple staffs to do a variety of things. You're asking us to separate those things out. From a time management perspective, it's a lot of time, a lot of money that we would have to invest in it. But more than anything else, here's the question I have for you. Why do we need excess revenue and expenditures that isn't already shown in net income? Nobody's even raised that there's an issue there. There's not a problem. The investments under assets have never been raised as a concern. Again, we report these on a quarterly basis. The salaries, of whom and why? I think that's really perhaps the net core of this. We're out after the salary information, and yet we're going to load up a whole bunch of other things in here that are expensive, time-consuming, and perhaps not necessary issues. Now, the salaries of these folks, the one that she did cite, the care organ is a 501c4, therefore they have to report it. These other organizations have blended salaries for CEOs, whether you're in Roseburg or Medford or here in Marion County. And what's the gain? What's the public policy benefit that we're going to get out of this? The education issue or the provider contracting issue? Other than what we already report on line 28, what else? Does anybody ever raise an issue that we need more, that there's a concern?
Sorry, line 28 of what?
Of the form that she passed out. I understand you passed out that form. This form, Mr. Chair, that was passed out. But the point is, that material is already reported. Now we have some interesting issues of proprietary nature, case management, claims review, and utilization review. Remember, these plans are the ones that came in when the commercial plans pulled out and left the Oregon Health Plan hanging. They agreed to take on some of these. The doctors got together, set up these programs, and they compete against each other. So are we making proprietary information now public information? And if that's the case, what's the public good? Is that to help the commercial folks? Or is there a way to actually make this bill different and have it report to DCBS and be confidential in nature like others individuals are? So in summary, Mr. Chair, I guess I want to make sure the committee understands that the vast bulk of this information is already available and seems to satisfy folks' need. We checked with DHS and said, are you advocating for the bill? No. I said, okay. So what do we need to get out? Why are these guys different than everyone else? Should we include everybody in the healthcare organization that deals with any part of the administrative programs within DHS as identifying their salary information and that? The question I have is goes back to clarify for me what the added benefit of this new reporting function will be. We have searched the annals of the process and talked to DHS, and we can't figure out, other than somebody wants to know the executive salaries of these individuals. But if that's the case, what's the benefit that brings to the process? But Mr. Chair,
I ask folks in the audience to shut off their cell phones. Not just silence them, but shut them off. We just heard cell phone go off, and it affects our recording system.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chair, I was just wrapping up. Thank you very much. We already provide a lot of information, and it isn't inexpensive for us to do it. I just want the committee to understand that we get rave reviews, my clients do, as for the services they provide individuals for the DHS-administered programs. There's a point in which when you ask for so much information that's already there, what's the value and what's going through and what are we trying to fix? And I would argue that there's a great yeoman's effort on this effort, but most of this stuff is already reported. I'm not sure the value of doing it differently. The generally accepted accounting practices, if you really look at them carefully, they are for accounting purposes, not performance-driven purposes. So the financial information is not necessarily the subjection of information that you'd want. And we oppose not only the amendments but the bill. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Are there any questions? either Debbie or Paul. Yes, Mr. Cote.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be honest, I'm not quite sure how I feel about all the information that we're that this bill would ask you to gather. But from my perspective, the policy goal that we're trying to deal with here is a vast amount of public dollars going to these plans and making sure there's acceptable levels of accountability. I think that one's crystal clear. Now, whether or not this gets there and whether it's the right thing to do, I think the policy decision is pretty clear of why we might want to pursue this.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative, I totally agree with you. You know, I spent 14 years in the legislature and 5 years in the governor's office, and I'm proud of my record in helping pass the Oregon Health Plan. No doubt that there should be disclosed good information there. The question becomes, if you go back and say, what's the goal of this bill, now these amendments, does it move the ball forward? And Representative, I would say we're presenting this information. No one has ever said it isn't enough, it isn't valuable, and this is one step above, so we're taking a series of more costs to accumulate the data that's already presented. And I just wanted, for the committee's sake, I mean, we...
Someone has said it's not enough.
What?
Somebody has said it's not enough.
Well,
Representative,
appreciate that. I guess, Mr. Chair, in summary, I agree with you, Representative, but the question is, does this achieve the goal that you want, or is it already there? And the one new piece of information seems to me to be the executive salaries, and, you know, that's there, but I just think from a management perspective of a guy that does a lot of it reporting, there are ways that if you wanted to say, DHS, improve this form to do it, pull the information out, tell us what's not there, that would be a better way than statutorily listing a whole series of other things and mixing a DCBS program with a DHS program.
There are other questions?
Follow-up?
Yep.
Thank you, and thank you for that response. And if, is this type of information just established in rule in terms of what they collect? I just don't know how this comes about. Is this, everyone sits down and says, this sounds like a good list. Is there a rulemaking process?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kotek, a few comments about what Mr. Phillips said. When he said nobody has asked for this information, I appreciate Chair Greenlink's comment that, yes, people have asked for this information. And, in fact, it was because people asked for information that Representative Tomei became aware of the fact that the CEO salaries weren't available. And then in pursuing it, we spoke with people at DHS and DMAP about it. It's my understanding, and you guys probably understand this way more than I do, that DHS has certain priority bills that they work on, and their staff then doesn't work on other things. And so we made a conscious effort to talk to the people at DMAP and ask them exactly what it is that you would need. And in those course of discussions, they provided a list of the kinds of administrative expenses that would help them to better evaluate both the financial solvency and the financial operations of the company. And in fact, it's that financial operations where we want to shine a light on the kinds of charges that our taxpayer dollars are going to increase transparency. Whether or not it's proprietary or not, you know, all of the OHP contractors would be required to give the same information. So so it's that notion of public accountability that we wanted to emphasize with this bill.
Did this come from DHS or
no?
Who wrote that?
This actually came from DMAP, yes. From Sandy Woods. Yeah. And we asked her to provide that for us.
There's no name on it, there's no letterhead, there's no...
She just sent it via email as a fact sheet.
And there isn't anybody here to testify.
I asked her if she could come, and she had a doctor's appointment today.
Okay. Should we hear from somebody from DMAP? Does that make sense? What's the pleasure of the committee?
Maybe we could recess and see if someone from DMAP comes.
Not today.
Okay.
Two big issues. I mean, we can hold till Friday.
Sounds good.
And ask for somebody to be medic. Does that make sense?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Thank you. I'm just referring back to the
April 9 testimony of Representative Tomei, wherein she states, or it is stated, that this bill stems from the news article that was attached in Oregon Health News regarding administrative costs for health contractors. And I recall hearing the oral testimony that said that was the premise for this legislation. I think you also said that you had heard complaints, so which came first? What did you know and when did you know it?
Mr. Chair, Madam Representative Flores, I believe that she read the newspaper article and then she talked to other folks around and they said, yes, we want to have it. So the article came first and then the complaints.
Complaints. Or just inquiries as to, yes, we've never asked for that, or if I might follow up, Mr. Chair. Or maybe now that we've seen this article, we've asked for this information and we haven't received it.
I'm sorry, I can't answer that. What she did, you'd have to ask directly to her how that proceeded.
Okay. I will hold this over till Monday. Penny, would you try and get some DMAC representatives here to talk to us about it?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee.
Thank you.
So, close the work session on House Bill 2952. Okay, we've got two big agenda items.
Oh, yeah.
HB 2801 and HB 3099. We'd said at 2801 we would, is that right, Representative Flores? We would invite some opposition testimony, because as I remember it in the original hearing in the subcommittee, we had 3 people sign up in opposition and 12 people sign up in support. We heard all 3 people in opposition, but it was in the subcommittee. We heard some of the people in support, and then we called some of those in support that were on that list back again. And now we're going to have an opportunity to hear some of the people in opposition again, so the full committee can hear that.
Mr. Chair, that's my understanding as well, and as I do understand, the timing element is approximately 35 minutes or so that you would allot to that.
Let's go.
And I appreciate your making that provision for the full committee to hear the other side of the discussion.
Right. Well, could we have, however you want to divide up that time, the folks in opposition? Only 2. Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Can I ask while they're coming up, is it your intent to have a continuation of the public hearing only, or are we having a work session, or is that going to be
this seen? This is really a work session of invited testimony. Did I open? Yeah, I think I opened that. Just in case I didn't. Open the work session on HB 2801. We have Bianca Werenberg and Father Ted.
Paholchik. Paholchik.
Oh, that was easy.
Yeah, it's better not to look at it.
Paholchik, yes, indeed. Go for it.
Oh, okay. I just want to say a few words. My name is Bianca Nirenberg, and I have a PhD in biochemistry. I was present here 2 weeks ago at the first hearing. I didn't have very much time to present, probably about half an hour worth of material, and I just wanted to summarize very quickly on a handout that's going around to you a few points about this type of research. And before I do that, I just want to point out I've worked in university research for many years, starting when I was 16, still in high school, did university-level research. and went through the ranks to postdoctoral research at OHSU. So I am very much pro-research. I do want, like many of us do, cures and treatments to be found for debilitating diseases and illnesses. However, as a scientist, one always has to, and as a person, one always has to ask the question, is what I'm undertaking an ethical activity? And as Father Tad will be talking about, what's proposed in this bill, HB 2801, is unethical science. And just quickly, if it weren't unethical science, it already would have been funded in the late 90s federally. And the reason that it hasn't been, or that things have gone the way they have, is because there are protections in place. Ever since Nazi Germany, there have been protections in place to protect human subjects from harmful research. So I would like the committee to just be alerted and aware that what you will be talking about if you vote for this bill is a significant departure from medical ethics as we know them, one ethics that protect human subjects. And I do want to give most of the time to the expert sitting next to me, Father Tad, but I've summarized some points on this handout to show that there are different types of stem cells. Human embryonic stem cells are the ones that you're proposing to fund in this this bill. And there's two red flags against them. One is they don't appear to be safe for putting into patients because in animals they tend to cause tumors. So my opinion as a scientist is that it will take many years or decades to perfect them to where they're actually safe. They are not a fast-track avenue to cures and treatments. And more importantly, as a scientist and as a person, they're not ethically derived. So I would just like to point out that I'm opposed to this bill, and that I believe there are other ways to use the dollars and scientific talent more wisely in Oregon and in our country. The very first idea I would have for you is to, for example, create an Oregon cord blood bank that would make life-saving cells available for some diseases. And that, in my opinion, is a fast-track type of approach to cures and treatments here in Oregon. And I yield my time to one of the world's experts in these subjects. He's a very eminent bioethicist, and we're blessed and fortunate to have him here today. So, Father Tad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. Thank you very much for allowing me to be with you this afternoon to discuss a bit further, a bit more in detail, some of the very significant ethical concerns that are raised intrinsically by these technologies, and specifically by HB 2801. I would like to...
Please introduce yourself.
Sure. My name is Father Tad Paholczyk, and I work for the National Catholic Bioethics Center. We're in Philadelphia, and my background is that I earned a PhD in neuroscience from Yale University. I did postdoctoral research at Harvard looking at cloning genes that are expressed in the brain, in the human brain, and was working in genetics very intensively. And after that, I went to Rome, studied to become a priest, and it was at that point that I focused very significantly on medical ethics and the issues of bioethics. And my focus for the past 7 years has been on stem cell research and human cloning in particular. So I travel around the country, actually around the world, and speak on this issue quite a bit. So the issue that's raised by this kind of legislation today, has been pointed out, is centrally an ethical one, that there are certain directions or avenues of research that raise moral objections and that require that we ask the question, just because we can, should we do something? And this is a perennial kind of question in science, and I'm going to share with you some of the reasons, and these are actually very secular reasons why this research is morally problematic. I think there's always an assumption, or at least, let's put it this way, a temptation by many who look at this to try to turn it into a kind of religious argument. Oh, you know, one religion thinks this, another thinks that, therefore nobody knows what anybody thinks, and therefore let us do our science.
Father Ted, would it help if we stipulate the answer to the question just because we can, should we, is no?
Okay, I think it would.
Yeah, that'll speed up the conversation.
Absolutely, I think it does. I think it's very helpful. All right, well, that's great. I think that's an initial supposition that must be granted. Anybody who looks at science, you know, has to recognize it's a power that can be used in bad ways as well. So what I'd like to do is just to speed through a few slides with you, kind of set a framework here, remind you the answer to the question of where do embryonic stem cells come from. They come from embryos, and from embryos that look like this. These embryos must be physically disaggregated or destroyed in order to establish a stem cell line from that embryo. So the basic procedure interrupts the timeline of the growing human being in a very direct and irreversible fashion. The net result is a cell line, and that line propagates itself potentially for decades or even centuries. It has been immortalized, one of its key features. So, okay, this guy gets out of the UFO here and is speaking with the Earthling and says, now don't panic, we're just here to do a little stem cell research. A cute cartoon, but also a reminder to us that whenever this issue is brought to the table to be discussed, there is an exploitative dimension that enters right away into the ethical discussion. So there's a myth out there that the Catholic Church, or more broadly Christians, or even others, are intrinsically against stem cell research. I think one of the key errors of this is that it doesn't discriminate the subtypes. So if you do a quick overview of the ethics, it's clear that it depends on the source. Where do you procure these cells from? So you do have the embryonic stem cells out of embryos, and it is correct that any research that requires the intentional destruction of younger human beings by older human beings will certainly raise red flags among Catholics, among Christians, and I would suggest to you among all men of goodwill. So this does represent an intrinsically problematic kind of research here. But other categories that you have include embryonic germ cells. These are also embryonic type, and they come typically from fetuses, usually from fetuses that have been aborted, but not necessarily. These could be gotten out of miscarriages or spontaneous loss of the pregnancy. And what you do is you remove those cells shown at the end of the red lines there and plate them as before to get a stem cell line. If you got them out of a miscarriage, there would not be any moral red flags that would be raised. From there, we can go on and look at another important category, which is the umbilical cord stem cells, already alluded to, no moral objections or ethical baggage that is associated with these. And finally, the adult stem cells present in all of our bodies. Virtually in every major organ system, you find pools of these cells. So, for example, bone marrow is a rich source. Or if you do liposuction, believe it or not, the fat contains significant numbers of adult-type stem cells. So the point is that there are many ethical venues for stem cells that are out there. And it's just a question of making a decision up front to pursue that ethical path. This next slide I'm going to show you is a listing of 10.
Excuse me, Father Ted.
Sure.
Yes, Representative Gelson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a question as you kind of delineated where the ethical flags come up. And you mentioned that some of the stem cells might come from fetuses that there's been a miscarriage, and you mentioned that, or from an abortion. And you indicated that it would not be a moral or an ethical issue if the stem cells were harvested from a miscarried fetus.
That's correct.
What is the ethical implication if there's an induced abortion, and the induced abortion is not for the intent of harvesting stem cells? Does that change the ethics of that act has already happened, And then the question is whether or not to immortalize those cells or just dispose of. Do you understand?
I do understand the question. It's a very good question, and the answer is that it does raise significant ethical concerns for the following reason: that in order to make use of tissues out of human donors, one of the cardinal requirements is that you obtain what's called informed consent. Now, the situation, whenever you get informed consent, if you yourself don't give it, if somebody close to you gives that consent, the presupposition is that they have your best interests in mind. So if they have your best interests in mind, then they can give consent. But the problem is that in a situation of an induced abortion, the mother has already indicated that she does not have her child's best interests in mind. By the very fact that she chose the abortion, she is unable to provide valid, informed consent for organ donations from her deceased child or for the use of any tissues for research. So those situations cannot be taken advantage of, so to speak. The child should simply be given a respectful burial at that point. So, you know, it's even if the abortion was done for completely separate reasons, which it usually was, for reasons of maybe, you know, family size or whatever the argument might have been, that does not in any way open up the possibility for the parents to hand over the cadaver of their child for organ or cell procurement.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
I have a question sort of along the same line, which is, again, trying to understand the ethical distinction, if there is one, between...
Cadney, I ask you, do you prefer to have questions as they come up?
Oh, sure, sure. I think it actually clarifies the material.
Thanks. I'm thinking about a couple that chooses to use in vitro fertilization in order to obtain a child, and my understanding of that process is that it produces often many more blastocysts than are able to be implanted, and the remainder are disposed, or in some cases, and perhaps more often if this legislation passes, used for stem cell research. What's the distinction between the use of the miscarried fetus, the ethical distinction, and the use of the blastocyst, which is going to be disposed of anyway?
Okay, if it's all right with you, I would like to maybe defer the answer to that, because I actually have a couple of slides that will address that specific question about the excess, quote-unquote, excess embryos.
Thanks.
Okay, great. Okay, so this slide that I have up here now is a listing of all the different flavors, if you will, of stem cell research that I was able to think up when I was approached to write a chapter of a book, a scientific book that looks at some of the ethical questions. And the point of this slide is that of the 10 different approaches listed there, 9 out of 10 don't raise any significant red flags under the appropriate circumstances. So in other words, most forms of stem cell research are morally clean and morally not problematic. And it's simply number one at the top of the list, which is the one that seems to garner most of the attention, and which unfortunately is really the central focus of this bill, 2801. It's been singled out as a kind of privileged one when, it is laden with very significant moral baggage and many, many viable alternatives present themselves. So I'm just going to mention two others from that list, two that are really brand spanking new, if you will. These are areas of research that have been published only within the last year that are very exciting developments. I mentioned the germ cells out of aborted fetuses or miscarriages. It turns out it doesn't have to come just from a fetus. You can actually get them also from adults who have died, from the testicles, believe it or not. This was done in mice in Germany originally. They did a testicular extract, and they were able to transmute these testicular cells into embryonic type stem cells. And as soon as this was published out of Germany, a startup company in California announced that they had been doing research using human cadavers and that they were also able to isolate these kinds of stem cells. The other category that I want to mention is one, it's a big long term called dedifferentiation. This is a really neat idea that if you take a regular cell, plain old garden variety cell like a skin cell, and dump some chemicals onto it, dump some gene products, you can trigger it to go backwards developmentally and turn into an embryonic type stem cell without ever generating any embryos anywhere. There was a paper out of Japan about 8 months ago that looked at this specific procedure. They identified four particular gene products that were required to do this. Many other labs in the U.S. and abroad are working on this because, as you might imagine, this is kind of like a gold rush here in the sense that if you could do this, you could just take my own skin cells and make a customized therapy without ever using embryos. So this is really very exciting kind of technology that shows us with a little creativity, a little bit of willpower and concern for moral boundaries, we have many other options available to us. So I have a couple of morally relevant distinctions which deal with human embryos that I'd like to share with you. The first one is this claim that embryos are merely cellular life, and I'm going to let the president of Advanced Cell Technologies, Michael West, he's got a company that's pushing human embryonic stem cell research vigorously, allow him to articulate this for us.
We're not talking about a human life. We're talking about cellular life. It's a fundamental distinction.
All right, he says we're not talking about human life. We're talking about cellular life. It's a fundamental distinction. Now, this is an argument that you frequently hear. It is also an argument that is scientifically inaccurate, incorrect, in the sense that the human embryo is not capable of giving rise to plants or giraffes or mice. It simply cannot do that. Its humanity is inscribed in its essential nature. Now, if you look at the genetic code of that early embryo, it is distinctly human. Again, not cat or dog or anything else. So the fact that it is human is established scientifically. It has nothing to do with religion, and is resolved by simple embryology. But as a kind of counterexample to his claim, there's a very useful thought experiment that I think clarifies some of the muddy waters that sometimes get stirred up around this. Presented by Paul Oritz, it involves a repugnance factor, and I'll explain what that is in a moment. What Paul Lauritsen said was the view that the early embryo is merely cellular material is equally implausible. In recent years, Leon Cass has spoken of the wisdom of repugnance. Leon Cass, by the way, is the former head of President Bush's Council on Bioethics. He's a MD, PhD fellow from the University of Chicago, very bright man. So this wisdom of repugnance, what is it? He said, well, back in the days when Dolly the sheep was cloned, if you walked out onto the street, gathered a group of people around you, and asked them, how do you feel about human cloning? The kind of answer you might anticipate would be, there's something not right about that. Something, you know, I can't tell you what it is. But they felt a visceral kind of a response, a repugnance. And Cass says, you know, there's something to that. We need to be in touch with it. It may be giving us insight into moral verities, moral truths. So over 20 years ago, Cass demonstrated this point dramatically in considering the status of the early embryo. If you're inclined to think that the embryo is just so much biological stuff, he said, try to imagine your reaction to the prospect of eating the blastocyst, which was the opening picture that I showed you, as a kind of human caviar. The revulsion we feel at this prospect should be enough to show us that the embryo, even the earliest embryo, is not nothing. It is life, indeed human life, which deserves respect. So this kind of puts us back into touch with something that we have fallen out of touch with by reflecting on this kind of thought experiment. Now, the second morally irrelevant distinction I'm going to let Senator Arlen Specter present. Again, this is a very popular one. It's the claim that, you know, if the embryo is not in a womb, it is somehow magically transformed into a non-embryo.
It was apparent from the outset that this had miraculous potential for Parkinson's and Alzheimer's and cancer and heart disease, and further, that these embryos where the controversy existed were going to be thrown away. Now, Gordon Smith Senator Smith has really put it very well. There's a big difference between the embryo in the womb of a woman, where life may eventuate, contrasted with being in a test tube in a laboratory where it's going to be thrown away.
All right, so if you kind of pare down his argument to its essential terms, what's he saying? If you change the location of the entity under consideration, you have changed its fundamental character and essence. And when I put it in those kind of bald terms, I think it becomes clear the fallaciousness of that line of thinking. But as a counterexample, I always
like...
That's
the only conclusion you can draw from that.
Well, I think it's one that is very strongly...
It would be the function of the embryo. The intent to use it in a certain way differentiates them.
But does it change the essence?
Not just the place.
Right, but the question is, does it change the essence of what is under consideration? That's the key philosophical error that is implicit in this.
No, that's exactly the question I would make. If you intend that embryo to be placed in a womb to create a human life, that's a meaningful distinction. And if you intend that embryo or blastocyst to be disposed of as medical waste.
But the question is, if I intend to dispose of you as medical waste, does that make you a non-human? It certainly does not. Intention doesn't change the essence.
It would make you a non-human, but the point is...
No, I put it that way simply to, you know, clarify the bounds of the thinking philosophically, that there is an error that has creeped in to suggest that intention can override essence when it never can. You can have the best intentions in the world, it doesn't change what it is that is fundamentally being considered. It can't.
But I'd like to follow on Representative Cannon's argument. And let's say for a moment that the blastocyst is alive. And let me step back to...
Did you say isn't alive?
No, let's say it is alive.
Okay.
Let's say it is human. Let's say it is alive.
Okay.
Let's stipulate that for a moment. For
as science does, yes.
Now let's say that a mother has a 3-month-old child, and the 3-month-old child is on life support and is going to die. And the mother now says, I'll immortalize my child by leaving his body to science so that the elements of this child's body can be used for research, and you certainly would give me the moral right to make that decision.
After the child had died, yes.
Well,
absolutely.
But in some cases it happens that you have to harvest organs while the child's still alive, even though the child is dead.
That's incorrect. If the child is not dead, there is what's called the dead donor rule, which may never be violated in transplantation ethics.
And the dead donor rule is?
That the donor must be dead for non-paired vital organs.
And the definition of dead?
That is a long and complex discussion. I'd be happy to get into it.
It's not laying in the ground.
No, it doesn't mean buried. It means that the organism no longer exists, and now only certain subfunctions of particular organ systems, for example, kidneys. But this is because the individual may be on a ventilator that is perfusing them artificially. But that individual is dead.
But in that case, it's all right for the mother to...
Yes, because the individual is dead.
And in a blastocyst that's about to be dead, you can arrange for it to be dead in the same kind of model. Would you not allow that mother to make that same decision?
The question would be, how did the blastocyst, how did that little embryo die? That's a critical question. If it was at the hands of a stem cell researcher, then it is intrinsically immoral, always, because he killed that embryo to obtain its cells.
Well, it's going to be dead in the hands of the in vitro fertilization clinic.
It is. Well, let me get to that, if I might, because I think that's exactly where the rubber meets the road, and this is what has happened. All right, let me just sort of address that before I get into this next section, because people say that, look, they're going to be thrown away anyway. They're going to be flushed down the toilet. They're going to all be thrown into the waste paper basket. Come on. We've got to make use of them. I mean, we'll maximize returns on investment.
I would say we have to make use of them. I would say that ought to be the parents' opportunity to immortalize that blastocyst.
Right, but the argument here is one of, you know, maximizing returns, that we need to make use of everything that we can. We don't want to see anything
go to waste. That's
not
an argument that I'm making.
Okay.
You can call it that, but that's not the argument I'm making.
Well, all right, if it's all right with you, let me address, since it was the one that was raised, I believe, by, was it Representative Cannon?
earlier. So let me address that one first. I'll come back to yours, and we can, you know, fine-tune whatever your particular angle on this would be. I'd be happy to dissect it with you. But the argument that Representative Cannon presented is the most common one, that they're all going to be thrown away anyway. We have to get some good out of them. Let's maximize these returns. Don't waste them. Come on, this is about waste. This is like recycling aluminum cans. It's the same mentality.
Is that your argument, Representative Cannon?
I actually do want to correct that. I was asking a question, not making an argument, and I think the argument, if one was to make it, might go that parents should have the choice to use a blastocyst, devote a blastocyst's life to this sort of research. But go ahead with your straw man. It's not me.
Okay, because that straw man is actually
very... the same argument as yours.
Okay, so the question of should the parents... I mean, the arguments actually coalesce into a single argument. The question is ultimately, should parents be permitted to dispose and hand over their own children to eager stem cell researchers? That's what it boils down to. Their children are alive, and are being handed over for the purposes of sacrifice. Is that permissible? Is that something that could fall within the canons of a good bioethics?
You can phrase your argument any way you want. That's not the way I would phrase that argument. Well, I would phrase that argument, these blastocytes are being handed over to be destroyed. Now, as a part of that handing them over to be destroyed, would it not be a greater social benefit to allow some of them to be immortalized in ways that will provide social good instead of simply being destroyed?
Well, would it provide greater social benefit? That's the question you asked. I would suggest to you it would not, because it would involve all of us in direct complicity with evil, which diminishes us socially.
Evil?
Absolutely.
Where did evil come from on this?
Okay, let me explain.
Destroying the blastocytes, is that evil?
What happens is this. In that argument, we're saying, look, somebody over there in the fertility clinic is going to throw away these embryos. Now, that act of throwing away the embryos...
My embryos.
Your embryos. Whoever's, my embryos, who's ever embryos. The problem is, isn't that action itself an evil action?
So the evil action that you're talking about now is the whole in vitro fertilization process.
No, we don't even have to go there. That's still an added level. We could go there later, but we don't have to even make that jump. All we have to say is, look, somebody's going to throw them away. Isn't that evil? And the answer is always and unconditionally yes. So the argument now reduces to very simple terms. That guy in the fertility clinic is going to do evil to the embryos. Quick, let's jump in line ahead of him and just do the evil first ourselves by disaggregating these young embryos. That's in the essence of the argument. One evil is being used to justify a second downstream evil.
In order to make that argument, you have to say the whole in vitro fertilization idea is evil.
No, you don't. You don't
have results in blastocytes that can't be used.
Mr. Chair, that's incorrect. I'm sorry to correct you on that, but all you have to say is there is a frozen embryo somewhere. How it got there is irrelevant to the question of the next step of what you will do to it. You don't have to go there. Now, if you want to go there, I would be happy to go there because I happen to think that in vitro fertilization has very significant moral difficulties. But from the point of view of this bill that is being discussed, we don't need to drag it in kicking and screaming.
Is that because God didn't intend the ova and the sperm to be met outside the body?
No, that's not the reason.
What is the reason?
The reason is that it violates, that's partly the reason. It violates the God-given designs of human sexuality. But that takes us very much lateral. I mean, if you want to go there, we can, but I think it makes more sense to focus on the central issue of the bill itself.
Thank you, and I do appreciate the intellectual inquiry, but I would really like to be able to get to the end of the presentation that, and I will not begin to say your last name, Father Tad has came to give to present to us.
Yeah, well, he did give us permission to have these.
Yeah, I appreciate the question.
Without going too far afield and some of the things that some of us may agree and some of us may respectfully disagree.
Sure.
Thank you.
Okay, so this argument then that the
changing of the location or the setting of the embryo somehow changes its essence. The way I usually like to counter that is to mention the example of Mark and Luke Borden. These are two cute little boys who were born from adopted frozen embryos. There's a program out there, it's called the Snowflakes Program. It's run by a Protestant group. And they link up these abandoned frozen embryos with others, couples who would adopt them, implant them, gestate them, and raise them as their own kids. So this next picture is a picture of Mark and Luke Borden. Their dad is in the middle. Their mom is on the left. She carried the pregnancy. And this was actually at some hearings on Capitol Hill about stem cell research. And the father, when he was holding the two boys like that, was very dramatic at one moment. He said, well, which one of my two boys, Mark or Luke, would you have chosen to destroy to prepare your embryonic stem cell lines? Question that I hope resonated with some of our lawmakers. And I like this next picture. It's a picture of Mrs. Borden holding three embryos, all of which were implanted into her, one of which did not take, the other two which did. So you see the picture of what Mark and Luke look like when they were much smaller. And, you know, a reminder to us of their simple embryonic origins. Now, the third morally relevant distinction is this claim, well, the embryo is so small. And I'm going to allow a scientist to argue this one for us.
I wanted to also come back to the nature of the entity that we're talking about, the early embryo, because I think it's really easily misunderstood.
Mm-hmm.
I've spent the last literally 30 years of my life concentrating on the first week of development of the mammalian embryo. And so I think I understand as well as anybody what it is. It's a hollow ball of cells, 100 cells. It's so tiny that it can...
Caryotic referred to as a blastocyst.
It's a hollow ball of cells called a blastocyst, and it's so tiny it fits on the point of a sewing pin. The point, not the head. You know how small the point of a pin is. So as far as distinguishing that, which is truly microscopic, from a person, it's something that is a very easy thing for an embryologist to do. And it's a shame to let people misunderstand the distinction between an early embryo produced by in vitro fertilization and a person.
Okay, so again, this is an argument that one encounters quite frequently. There's a conscious attempt to minimize and ultimately depersonalize what the human embryo actually is. Now, this professor is correct that embryos are small. This next picture that I'm going to show you is literally an embryo sitting on the point of a sewing pin. And, you know, people say, well, it's so small, it's so different from us, it doesn't have hands, it doesn't have feet, it doesn't have eyes for us to look into. How can you seriously treat something that small the same way that you treat somebody who's an adult, especially if that adult might, perhaps, possibly, some time down the road, benefit from his own health if we choose to destroy that embryo today? And, you know, yet, and I mean, I remember one time a person holding up a blank sheet of paper, taking a dot, a pencil, putting a dot onto that paper and saying, this is all about dots. This is nothing but dots that we're talking about. How can you get all excited about dots? But, you know, the issue here is not whether the embryo is small or not. The issue, when you see a picture like this, which is a scanning electron micrograph of an 8-cell human embryo, when you look at a picture like this, the question to ask is a very simple one. Isn't this exactly what a young human is supposed to look like? And that affirmation doesn't depend on religion, doesn't depend on value systems, doesn't depend on imposing anything on anyone. This is what a young human is supposed to look like. Sometimes when I show this picture, I say to people, you know, as unfamiliar as this is to all of us, it actually is a kind of family photo. This is where each of us came from. So this is a hard thing for people to see, you know, because it is so unfamiliar. No arms, no legs. So how do we reconnect with our own origins here? I want to share with you an example that I think fleshes this out and really clarifies the matter. It involves the American bald eagle, our national bird, our great national bird. In the past, this bird was on the endangered species list, you probably recall. I don't think it is any longer. But in 1940, we passed a very interesting federal law
that protects this bird. And it's interesting because if you read the text of this law, it basically says if you're out there in the wilderness walking around and you've got your shotgun draped over your shoulder and you come across one of these birds flying gloriously in the clouds overhead and you shoot the bird out of the air, the law stipulates that you will suffer very stiff penalties, X, Y, and Z. Right in the text of the law, they include the penalties. Now, you keep reading the same text of the law. It also mentions that if you're out in the wilderness and you come across the nest of a bald eagle with eggs in that nest, and you destroy just one egg, you suffer exactly the same penalties, X, Y, and Z, as if you had shot the bird out of the air. Now, that makes perfect sense to anybody who just reflects for a moment on it. Why? Because if eagles are valuable for pragmatic purposes of preserving them, you'll seek to safeguard them at all stages of their existence, from the very beginning to very end. I mean, why? What's so special about that eagle's egg? What's actually inside that egg? It is an embryonic eagle, the very same creature, the very same animal that flies in the clouds overhead. And even a perfect, resolute, and total atheist appreciates the cogency of a law like that. And yet somehow, as soon as we start talking about our own humble embryonic origins, we go through all kinds of mental somersaults and circumlocutions to try to justify what is intrinsically unjustifiable. And this is the central reason that 2801 represents an unethical kind of legislation that should never be passed in a civilized society. So he says, harvesting human stem cells, or stem cells from human embryos, like the one in this petri dish, will save lives. And the little guy on the right says, not mine. That's what the ethical controversy is swirling around. So this myth about frozen embryos, I've alluded to it already. Because the frozen embryos may one day end up being discarded by somebody, that makes it morally allowable, even laudable, to violate and destroy those embryos. This argument has become so seductive in our day when we have failed to take the step backwards and say, who's throwing them away? And shouldn't that be a point of profound moral examination and concern, which indeed it should. And the whole in vitro industry is like the Wild West of infertility. It is a huge medical procedure that is essentially unregulated. And that's how we got into the tragic moment where we find ourselves with 400,000 frozen embryos. 400,000. You know, out of those 400,000, there's a claim, oh, they're all going to be thrown away. Well, if you actually count up all those embryos and ask the parents, do you want to throw away your embryos? They did a study, a RAND Corporation-financed study, and you know what they found? That 88.2% of all the frozen embryos, the parents don't want to throw them away. They don't want to hand them over to the stem cell researchers. They want to use them for family building. These are their own kids, and they know it. So 88%. So this claim that there are hundreds of thousands and they're all going to be thrown away is a misleading claim that is used to bait people into thinking that we can go down this rabbit hole.
And the other 12%?
The other 12%, well, there's 2.2% actually that are slated for destruction. Only 2.2% of the 400,000. And another 2.8% that were designated for research. So roughly 5% altogether that would be available, assuming that the ones that were slated to be discarded, that you could get the consent. Now, that means only about 11,000 embryos, and if you do the math, when you freeze an embryo and then thaw it, about half those embryos don't survive the thawing. So you're down to 6,000 embryos, and then you do the math still further. When you derive stem cells, only 1 out of 10 derivations works. So you're getting down to maybe, you know, a few hundred cell lines. And you talk to the stem cell researchers, what do they say? We need to have stem cells that will represent the whole population. We need millions. We need to make new embryos. And, of course, the bill sanctions cloning. Pardon?
Are you about done?
Yes, very close to done. Very close to done. Can I have 5 minutes?
You can.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. All right, so discarding embryonic humans, I have this video clip that just shows how this actually occurs, because this is really the point that we need to back up to and examine. This is from 60 Minutes, by the way.
In fact, there are 400,000 frozen embryos in storage and fertility clinics across the country.
This is the place that we store all the cryopreserved embryos in our program.
Dr. Richard Scott, who runs a fertility clinic in Morristown, New Jersey, stores 7,000 frozen embryos in large liquid nitrogen tanks.
And each, there would be one cane for each patient that would hold all of the embryos that they have frozen.
So each one of these
is a different patient.
And it can cost a couple up to $2,000 a year to store their excess embryos, which are frozen at 321 degrees below zero.
Some patients ultimately will finish their family, maybe they have a couple of embryos in storage. They do decide to discard those. That's their decision.
How are they discarded?
We simply remove them from the liquid nitrogen, they thaw, and then we discard them in biohazard waste. They're in cells. They would be discarded the way any other cell that was removed from the body would be discarded.
Biohazard waste.
Mm-hmm.
Biohazard waste, medical waste. You know, I think this is the tragedy of our day, that we have gotten to the point that we have subjugated our brothers and sisters who are still young and vulnerable to the waste bin in this fashion. This is something that we have to, as a society, return to and examine. So the moral analysis here of embryonic inviolability doesn't hinge on whether the embryo is trapped in liquid nitrogen through no fault of its own and might one day end up being violated or discarded by somebody. So my last two slides here. All of this is a call to some serious ethical discernment. And, you know, our lawmakers have a real obligation here to go deep, because you're making some decisions that affect the whole future trajectory of this kind of research. This is from Dr. Cass again. He says, to seize the occasion, you must, as the late Paul Ramsey said, raise the ethical questions with a serious and not a frivolous conscience. A man of frivolous conscience announces that there are ethical quandaries ahead that we must urgently consider before the future catches up with us. By this, he often means that we need to devise a new ethics that will provide the rationalization for doing in the future what men are bound to do because of new actions and interventions science will have made possible. In contrast, a man of serious conscience means to say, in raising urgent ethical questions, that there may be some things that men should never do. The good things that men do can be made complete only by the things they refuse to do. All right, well, thank you very much, Mr. Chair, for your patience. I'm
thank you
very grateful.
It's too bad we don't have another 3 hours to sit in.
May I add
one very
short comment?
Very short.
Very short. I have my email address on my handout, and because I am a resident in the Portland area, I'd be happy to answer questions with you one-on-one or in a small group setting if you'd like me back at any time. I hope to be able to help you through the scientific questions you may still have, and please feel free to contact me.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Representative Braun has an amendment proposed. Perhaps you'd explain it.
I would. There's actually two amendments I'll tackle. And can I, do you want me to move it? Move one, or just want me to talk about it?
Just the one.
But would you like me to move it or just talk about it before?
Why don't you talk about one? Then we'll
basically, Mr. Chair, you recall that we had, at least, I should say we, I had my first introduction to this bill last Friday when we heard it the first time in front of the full health care committee. I wasn't part of the access committee where it was originally heard. And I had, when I read the bill, looked at the bill, I had the same concerns, or some of the same concerns that were voiced today, in that the bill specifically focused, 2801 specifically focused on embryonic stem cell research, and then within that it touched upon both in vitro embryonic research as well as, the therapeutic cloning, the other types of embryos that were...
Hepatic cell nuclear...
There you go. Yeah, thank you. And I thought, you know, I understand, you know, obviously this is an issue that it raises some great moral concerns with some people. And my, one of my early concerns was why I think there's great benefit to stem cell research. Did some research over the weekend, research in my own home, but this is from a issue of National Geographic. It's a cover article on stem cells, and it lists the top five diseases in which stem cells, and it doesn't differentiate in the approach to how these diseases are being affected or treated, doesn't differentiate between adult stem cell or embryonic stem cell, but says heart disease, cancer, rheumatoid arthritis, Parkinson's disease, and type 1 diabetes are the top five areas of progress in stem cell research right now. And as I've voiced to this committee before, I happen to have three of the five. So I take a very, you know, direct interest in stem cell and stem cell research. But I have the moral concerns as well. I feel that, I am pro-life. I'm a humble pro-life, and I take the distinctions that were voiced here and with the testimony earlier to heart. And so I thought, as a start, we ought not just limit this to the area of stem cell research that has the moral concerns. Broad-based adult stem cell research, as was testified to, has no moral concern that I'm aware of. So let's broaden this bill at the very least to take in all of stem cell research, including the adult stem cell, which they're doing wonderful work with at OHSU currently.
And Representative Galizio said that he's talked to you about it, that putting on the record doing this versus amendment, broadening it, doesn't exclude embryonic stem cell research, but it just includes the whole
field. Yeah, the Dash 1 amendment, Mr. Chair, is the most simple amendment I think I've ever seen for a fairly complex bill. It merely goes through, and I've done it, I could point it out to you, but it merely goes through House Bill 2801, and every time embryonic or embryo is mentioned in the bill, it removes that. So the remaining language says, let me give you an example, lines 2021. The bill, as it's written, says, whereas several states have supported policies and institutions in partnership with the biomedical research industry to promote and advance embryonic stem cell research, the word embryonics removed. And that's consistent throughout the entire bill. It just, everything that was embryonic stem cells, now stem cell research.
Grisio's position and was that he would be happy to accept the Dash 1 amendments. I'm a co-sponsor, I am as well, as long as we put on the record it's intended to include all kinds of stem cell research.
Dash one is.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to make that clarification, too, and I'm quickly reading through, and I'm wondering, on page 2, line 34, when it's talking about the people that are part of this committee, in that use of embryonic stem cell, it's two persons with backgrounds in legal issues related to human embryonic stem cell research, in vitro fertilization, or family law as it applies to the donation of blastocysts and sites. And I'm wondering if that one in particular might make sense to keep the embryonic in, since that does not refer to adult stem cell research. And it seems appropriate that if it is broadly applying to all stem cell research, that the commission would want to have people there that did have that legal expertise in terms of the
right. Can I comment on that?
Sure.
Thank you, Representative. I hear what you're saying on that. I don't think by removing the word embryonic, I mean, there's some more issues that removing the word embryonic for those who have some moral opposition to this. This doesn't fix the bill for that, and we can talk about that after we have this discussion. This particular example, when it goes on to talk about in vitro fertilization and the donation of blastocysts, that's still what we're talking about here. So I don't think there's going to be any confusion that in that particular example, those sorts of actions are talking about embryonic. They're not talking about adult stem cell when we talk about in vitro fertilization.
So follow up.
I don't think.
So even in that, I just want to be completely assured that the intention of the Dash 1s is not to remove any focus or access to or discussion of the use of embryonic
Correct. There are dash twos to talk about, but the intent of the dash ones is simply to take what was a could be construed as a narrowly focused bill, a bill that was specifically focused on the various forms of embryonic stem cell research, and to take out that and to make it applicable to all forms of embryonic, adult, the things that were mentioned today that we haven't heard of before. I mean, anything that we could possibly think of along the lines of stem cell research, that is what the language change in dash one is trying to solve.
We have a motion to adopt the dash one.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I would move the dash one amendment to House Bill 2801.
Is there any discussion? Any objection? Dash one to append it to House Bill 2801. There was less interest in the dash two because it changed a piece of the basic nature.
Yep.
I think I prefer to go along with only the dash one.
Okay, can I address the
Please.
Dash two?
Okay.
The dash two amendments are designed to address, not solve, but address a larger moral concern, which was, in my opinion, very eloquently addressed today. The dash two amendments are designed to look specifically at the embryonic aspect of the larger stem cell world, and even more narrowly defined within the embryonic world, to take away the cloning aspect. Once again, get my terminology, the therapeutic cloning. This is not talking about embryos that are in a fertilization center somewhere. This is talking about potential embryos that are created for the specific task, specific purpose to harvest the stem cells out. So it would be creating in a cloning sort of environment these human embryos, and then you know the research as was discussed, the harvesting. Once again, not to solve the moral issues regarding embryonic, but there's some people, as was addressed earlier, who are not clear on how they feel about what happens with these embryos that are in fertilization centers. However, I think the clearing, at least from my perspective, is much clearer on what or what not to do with the therapeutic cloning. And I, for one, find it aberrant that we're talking about human cloning, whether it's at any form at any stage in the developmental cycle. I think we're talking about eugenics here, and I think it's a path that we don't want to go down, Mr. Chair. That's my humble opinion on that, and that's the genesis behind that's the idea behind the dash twos. The dash twos do not solve. The dash twos do not cover the entire issue of embryonic stem cell research, and so the moral issues that remain regarding whether or not it's appropriate or not to use embryos that would otherwise be discarded from an in vitro fertilization center, those are not solved by these dash twos. And people that have, once again, have a moral objection, I've talked to a few of them, they're not satisfied with the dash twos. They don't go far enough, frankly.
Well, how about this? How about if we close the session and you and I and Representative Buizzi will have a chance to talk or something? Anybody else would like to join us in that discussion? Let's take a serious look at the dash twos. Great.
And Mr. Chair, I would be honored if you would allow me to enter your discussion. I come from it certainly from a lesser degree of expertise and experience and clinical training than you do, but I can certainly guarantee you'll have my opinion.
No, that's good. Let's get the four of us together and see what we can do with the
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's great. I appreciate it.
So I will close the work session on 2801. We've adopted the dash one amendments. We'll have some discussion. Put it back for Friday. We're going to have a busy Friday and Monday. In addition, I think, given the time constraints, we're going to need to carry over House Bill 3099 till Friday. And we'll...
Your pajamas.
Well, we're going to have to carry...
Yeah.
Well, not Friday, but bring pajamas for Monday, because I think we'll need to... Do we have permission to go late on Monday? We'd ask for it.
Yes, and Friday too.
Okay.
But I'm not. You're on a close tie right now.
Yeah, I think we.
Pajamas.
Yeah. Well, I think we'll try and work hard and work till 5 on Friday, and then go as long as we need to go on Monday. So please try and make arrangements to be with us on Monday. If worse comes to worse, we'll get some pizza in, but we'll have a better understanding of how things are going. No, we've heard too much about making decisions on beer. We won't be doing that. Thank you all for your hard work today. I really did appreciate the presentation today. Father Ted still here? Yeah, it took me back to my college days where we could spend some time, my graduate school days, spend some time arguing with those issues, and I very much enjoyed your presentation. Thank you. I'll close the House Committee on Health Care meeting. We have a access meeting on Wednesday. Finish up that work, and then we got to start getting ready. We had some discussion about how to facilitate what we're doing. We'll continue to talk about it for our May